Hope everyone's prepared to manage through the longest, at least mentally and physiologically, longest part of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's winter, after the holidays, but before spring. Keep the faith. It's already getting better, with daylight lasting a little bit longer each day. And for you Southern Hemisphere constant listeners, hey, send us some sun and warmth our way, would you? I am Nick Deolius. I'm the host of The Far Middle. I am on X, LinkedIn, YouTube. Just type in NickDeulius. You'll find me. I'm glad you're here on the podcast, and I hope you land there on those platforms down the road as well. Sports dedication time is our Far Middle custom. I do have a fun one this week, and it relates to a prior dedication subject. Coach Red Auerbach. I think he was dedication subject back for episode 119. And he wrote an autobiography in the 1960s. And in that book, Red Auerbach talked about how Bob Cousy, the legendary Celtics guard and the NBA all-time great, how Cousy came to play and win numerous titles in Boston with the Celtics. The way it happened wasn't by design, and it was instead by fortuitous, bordering on forced accident. Now, see if you can believe this story. It's an amazing story. 1950, NBA draft. And we found that Boston, with its new coach, Red Auerbach, had the first overall selection in that draft. And that was the same draft that Bob Cousy was available coming out of Holy Cross, where he was a highly touted player and very well known to Boston area basketball fans. And a lot of people in Boston, including the media, wanted the Celtics to take the local kid with the first overall selection in the draft. But Coach Red, Auerbach was not impressed with Cousy at the time. Instead, Auerbach had his eyes on an All-American center from Bowling Green, and that's who the Celtics indeed selected, passing on Cousy. Auerbach, when pressed on his choice right after the draft, he famously said, "Am I supposed to win or please the local yokels?" Well, the local media strongly criticized Auerbach after that quote. And Coach Red questioned whether Cousy would even be able, frankly, to make it in the pros as a guard. And after Auerbach passed on Cousy with the draft's first selection, Cousy was selected by Tri-Cities third overall. Now, you might hear Tri-Cities. That was an NBA franchise. Keep in mind, this is prehistoric NBA. And when Cousy was selected by Tri-Cities, he was then quickly traded to the Chicago Stags, which then promptly went bankrupt as a team. And when teams folded up back then, the players on that team were up for grabs by the remaining teams. Auerbach referenced such players as homeless athletes. That's what he called them in his book. And the league called a special meeting in 1950 to dispense with those homeless athletes, so to speak, and assign them to the remaining NBA teams. After some early agreed on decisions by most of the teams regarding most of the now teamless players on the board, there were three teams and three big names and high-priced players who were left. And Cousy was one of those three high-priced players left. Now, when I say high-priced, what do you think his contract was for? $8,500 a year, mind you. That's back then, how things have changed. An hour back, and his boss, the legendary Celtics owner, Walter Brown, they wanted either of the two other players remaining much, much more than Cousy. And the other two teams who were left, the New York Knicks and the Philadelphia Warriors, they saw it exactly the same way, with the other two players that were left being much more desirable than Cousy. So the three teams couldn't work out voluntarily how this was going to go on their own. So that meant that the league commissioner finally said enough. He told the three owners to draw the three remaining player names out of a hat to set where each of the three remaining players went to each of the three remaining teams: New York, Philly, and Boston. New York was allowed to pick first, and it came up with the consensus most coveted of the three players when it pulled its name out of the hat. So they were thrilled. Philadelphia went next. They pulled the name that the three teams agreed was the second best choice. That left the Celtics being stuck with Bob Cousy, the last name left in the hat, the guy they didn't want, nor did New York or Philly. Walter Brown, again, that Celtics owner, his comment when he was left with Cousy as his player: "I guess I got the dirty end of the stick." Well, only if you call one of the greatest players in the history of the game the dirty end of the stick. Yeah, one of the best things to ever happen to the Celtics and to Auerbach had to be fished out of a hat and forced upon him, literally. That's how life sometimes works, constant listeners. Fate can have a sense of humor as well as a sense of irony. So episode 190 is dedicated to how Bob Cousy became a Celtic, proving truth in the adage that sometimes it is indeed better to be lucky than good. Let's start the meat of this episode with a little inspiration from one of the greatest thought leaders of the 20th century and a multi-episode far middle subject, Soviet dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He once wrote, "In keeping silent about evil and burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the surface, we are implanting it, and it will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we are not simply protecting their trivial old age, we are thereby ripping the foundations of justice from beneath new generations." That's pretty resounding, and perhaps the biggest lesson that Solzhenitsyn taught us is that no matter how long the odds may appear, the truth in the end is going to come out stronger. And that belief has been a pillar of the far middle philosophy since the podcast first appeared 190 episodes ago. We can make an appropriate connection to how the truth is becoming stronger when it comes to the reality on the ground with war in the Ukraine. Talked about Ukraine the last few weeks on the far middle. You know that I support Ukraine and its David versus Goliath confrontation with Russia. And I am so impressed with the ability of Ukraine's fighting forces to withstand and repulse that initial invasion across the country, and then its ongoing tenacious resistance through the past few years. It's been amazing, inspiring to watch. But I also recognize that Western media has sold and fed the public a litany of lies, from ignoring and glossing over how the West played a role in instigating the conflict with Russia, to sort of deflecting harsh realities pertaining to Ukraine's willingness or maybe societal unwillingness to fight, depending on what demographic you look at. Yeah, Ukraine is facing a credibility problem when it panders and pushes the West for more military aid and assistance, and certainly when it lobbies for the approach of escalation, such as using long-range missiles to strike deep within Russia instead of pursuing a rational, negotiated peace. Frankly, I don't see how Ukraine can win this war, at least as Zelensky defines winning, which is a return of all occupied land that Russia now holds in eastern Ukraine. It's not going to happen, and the trend will be in the opposite direction as Russia continues to push westward in regions like the Donbass. And a big reason why the war as defined by Zelensky is not winnable, and the time is not on Ukraine's side, is that young Ukrainian men are not exactly signing up in droves to do their part by serving on the front lines of the war. Ukrainian officials are now deploying nationwide dragnets, searching for young men to shore up its crumbling and thin front lines. You'll find government officials checking the paperwork of young Ukrainian men at concerts, bars, restaurants, and nightclubs from Kyiv to Odessa. And yes, oddly enough, as Ukraine fights for its survival, many young adults are living a normal life in the larger cities outside the immediate front lines. And Ukrainian elites, they don't hesitate to work the system to avoid military service. And Ukraine certainly isn't the first place or time we've seen that happen. There's a scandal now where state prosecutors have been exposed when they avoided the draft through questionable medical exemptions. And the nation's attorney general had to resign over the controversy toward the end of last year. And the government's planning to audit companies across the nation who secured exemptions from the draft for their employees who were designated as essential. I suspect that audit might uncover some ugly truths. Ukraine recently reduced the age of compulsory military service to 25. Americans and Westerners, they're sometimes shocked to hear the age of conscription into Ukraine in the middle of a war for its existence was until recently in the late 20s. Now it's down to 25. Indeed, Americans are surprised to hear that because, you know, we're in the mindset of 18-year-olds being sent off to fight in wars from World War II to Vietnam to Desert Storm. But that's not the case currently in Ukraine. And why is that? Well, first, lowering the draft age, that's going to be politically unpopular, even though Ukraine faces an existential threat. And then second, Kyiv says a lower draft age would worsen a demographic crisis that is a threat to Ukraine's future. Ukraine's lost more than a quarter of its 40 million pre-war population because of that toxic cocktail of Russian occupation, war deaths, and millions exiting Ukraine and fleeing to other nations. There's also a troubling bias that's found in Ukraine's approach to drafting soldiers for the army. Something even more disturbing, I think, than its age discrimination given pass to younger able-bodied men. And that is the disproportionate burden shouldered by small towns and rural areas of Ukraine versus the big cities. Up until recently, draft officers and government dragnets, they targeted the smaller towns and villages because the government was afraid of political blowback and social unrest that would be caused by enforcing draft rules and compulsory military service rules in big cities like Kiev and Odessa. But as Ukraine's army becomes increasingly brittle and more exhausted and fragile, a fairer approach to mobilization and drafting into the military is finally now occurring. And that age of compulsory military service, as I said, it's dropping to 25. And the government's making systemic efforts to enforce the rules and pull in those looking to avoid the rules. And the process is now being applied more evenly between urban and non-urban regions of the country. So young men skirting the military and the rules, they're not just being pulled from villages, but also from large cities where many of them have lived and behaved as if there was no existential conflict going on within the country's borders. Now, this can't happen soon enough for Ukraine. Because, as I said, its front lines, they're in trouble. They're collapsing under constant Russian pressure. The average age of frontline troops is absurdly high, some data showing in the upper 40s, approaching 50. And those troops, they've been on the front line for way too long. They suffered attrition levels that combat stress would break under any human or destroy the cohesion of any combat unit. And it's not unusual to find soldiers who have been serving on the front lines for years. They're incredibly brave, and I suspect those Ukrainian heroes, and that's what they are, would not view their fellow countrymen and younger countrymen who avoided military service favorably. To make matters worse, now Ukrainian troops, they're increasingly abandoning their positions or deserting the army under this unbelievable stress. So before Ukraine looks to convince the West to better arm it and to fund it and to effectively escalate the war with Russia, Ukraine would be well served to demonstrate that it's engaging in some self-help and leading by example when it comes to its own citizens and commitments. And without that, Zelensky's credibility is going to suffer on the world stage and with those that he relies on the most for support. And I cannot emphasize this enough. Even if Ukraine gets its house in order with its young men serving in its military, it only buys time and a better window for a sensible peace settlement with Russia. Ukraine will bleed out before it wins, as defined by a return of all of its occupied territory, if that's how you define winning. All of this assumes, of course, that escalation of the conflict beyond Ukraine is a non-starter and is in no one's best interest. There's a connection to make to the situation with what's going on with compulsory military service in Ukraine, with what the media has sold us compared to what is actually occurring, to a troubling incident right here in the United States, one that the media has also failed to expose. Let's connect with the details. Last March, there was an individual who was the executive director of the airport in Little Rock, Arkansas. That's the Bill and Hillary Clinton National Airport. And the individual was shot and killed by agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or what's commonly referred to as the ATF. The killing occurred during a pre-dawn raid of the individual's home. Now, you'll have trouble finding news about this incident, and to my knowledge, the ATF has faced no sort of repercussions because of its actions that led to the killing, which, once you hear the details of, is probably going to bother you greatly. The person killed was a collector of coins and firearms. And he would display both the coins and the firearms at gun shows, and at those shows, he would occasionally buy or sell firearms. Federal law allows buying and selling of firearms if you're a collector or a hobbyist without the need for a federal firearms license. You don't need a federal firearms license unless you're engaged in the business of selling firearms, and Congress has defined what constitutes being engaged in the business for us. It said it applies to those who deal in firearms as a regular course of trade or business with the principal objective of livelihood and profit, as opposed to those who make occasional sales, exchanges, or purchases of firearms for the enhancement of a personal collection or for a hobby. That sort of makes sense, that definition. And again, this individual already had a livelihood. He was running a large airport. The firearms sidebar was done in his spare time, so he didn't see the need for a license. But that's not the way the ATF came to see it. At some point, the ATF made the unilateral determination that the individual was engaged in the business of selling firearms. And this is where things went disturbingly wrong. The ATF didn't contact the individual by mail or by phone or in person to let him know that he now needed a license. And by the way, for context, the annual fee for the license is $65. Instead, the ATF sent several undercover agents to surveil the individual at gun shows. It put a GPS tracker on his vehicle, and the ATF secured a search warrant for his home. So talk about a police state. The first time the ATF showed up at his house to serve the warrant, nobody was home. The second time they showed up, they were in SWAT gear. They added Little Rock police to the team, and they rolled in with 10 vehicles to the individual's home before dawn. They cut power to his house. They covered up the doorbell camera so that the residents couldn't see who was there. And in about a minute of time after an exchange of gunfire, the individual was dead. Oddly, no government agents were wearing activated body cameras during the incident, which is a violation of both ATF and Little Rock police protocols. And after the individual was shot and killed, his wife was forcibly taken outside the home in her nightgown in 34-degree weather and held for 4 hours outside, I think in a police vehicle. And she was understandably hysterical. Now, this was a tragedy that obviously resulted in the death of an individual. And you didn't hear hardly anything about this across mainstream media. Yet it's strange that it parallels in some ways something happened later last year that a lot of people have heard about, and it happened to, of all things, a social media animal celebrity. I'm talking about Peanut the Squirrel. Now, that's the much better known event where New York State agents showed up at Peanut's owner's home. They forcibly entered, they detained the squirrel's owner and spouse, and then they killed the squirrel to supposedly test it for rabies, along with a pet raccoon. Why? Because the owner didn't have the pets licensed with the state. Now, these two incidents are the types of situations we expect to hear coming out of Russia or China, and examples of why the West should try to rationally and responsibly support Ukraine where it can to protect Ukraine from an authoritarian Russian regime. But these incidents didn't happen in Beijing or in Moscow. They happened in Arkansas and New York. A person was killed. Civil liberties were trampled. The government acted on a totalitarian state basis, and much of the mainstream media was silent, looked the other way on reporting either story. Yeah, the threat of omnipotent government is greater than most Americans realize. You don't need to be pro-gun or pro-squirrel to be concerned, because these two examples show anybody can be at risk. You might be next, which is why a return to rational balance between state power and individual freedoms will be a much welcome theme this year and into the coming years. Let's jump via connection to go from government overreach with power to assaulted citizens to an area of government falling short of fulfilling its duties of power. And here I'm talking figuratively and literally. There is a growing danger that's approaching. It's a self-inflicted energy scarcity crisis. And yes, I recognize that the incoming administration in DC is all about energy security and a return to energy independence and drill, baby, drill and all that great stuff. But there has been so much damage done the past decade to our collective energy security that we may face a breaking point in crisis before we return to stability. And if we do face such a crisis, it's going to likely occur on our power grids. Here's what the nation's grid regulators are saying. Quote, I am extremely concerned about the pace of retirements we are seeing of generators, which are needed for reliability on our system, end quote. And that was from the chairman, none other, of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or the FERC. That was in 2023. Another FERC commissioner said, the red lights are flashing. The Midwest is a prime example. Its grid is in trouble. In early 2024, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, which covers 15 states in Middle America, is commonly referred to as MISO, it warned of urgent and complex challenges to electric system reliability. The NERC, which oversees grids across all of North America, agrees and it expects MISO in the Midwest to face a massive capacity shortfall in less than 4 years. Now, what caused this crisis? I mentioned it was self-inflicted, and it was brought to us by the climate alarmist and radical environmental movement. Every time you heard energy transition, net zero, clean energy, or tackling climate change, That was code oftentimes for forcing the retirement and abandonment of reliables on the grid, which is coal, nuclear, natural gas power plants, and mandating their replacement with the unreliables of wind and solar, which was coupled to coincide with a mandated electrification of everything. You saw that through the efforts to ban natural gas in homes, and you saw it with the phasing out of gasoline-powered transportation vehicles and replacing them with EV mandates. So to give you an idea of how ridiculous these climate policies have been, consider a study by Princeton that estimated to achieve net zero carbon emissions in the power sector with carbon capture technology, it would require almost 70,000 miles of carbon transport pipelines. Think about how painful and long it would take to simply gain permit approval from an alphabet soup of government regulatory agencies to simply start construction of 70,000 miles of pipeline. It's never going to happen, which means such solutions and plans and policies are, as I said, ridiculous. But the ridiculous can wreak havoc, wreck a power grid in the interim before the policy is exposed. And that's exactly what's happening. Other studies show that over 600,000 miles of new transmission lines would need to be built to achieve net zero electricity. Now, short transmission lines can take up to 15 years for approval in construction. How long do you suppose it would take to construct 600,000 miles of new transmission lines? I'm not even going to speculate on how long because it's not going to happen. America is facing a shortfall of at least 30% of electrical grid capacity by 2032. You could quadruple the number of nuclear plants in the United States and it would barely cover the shortfall. But we haven't built a new nuclear plant since the 1970s because of the environmental movement dictating policy. Even the unreliable sources of power, such as solar, they're running into regulatory impediments to scale as well. The Bureau of Land Management, the BLM, is placing numerous obstacles in the path of solar project developers. Over 80% of BLM land cannot be developed for solar energy due to regulation. And now solar is also encountering nonsensical regulations that natural gas, oil, coal, and the nuclear industry have experienced for years. Prohibitions on grading land and development within hundreds of feet of intermittent streams is an example. The radical environmental movement and the Code Red crowd are not really about fossil fuels, and it's not really about atmospheric CO2. They are about control of the individual and manufacturing energy scarcity to do so. And the evidence keeps piling up in undeniable fashion. Yeah, so these are sort of some of the reasons as to why media credibility is at an all-time low and might frankly never recover. It refuses to report on government trampling citizen rights. It looks the other way on the problems of Ukraine's home front and its commitment to the war with certain key demographics within its population. It's silent on the pending grid power crisis, but the media is still reporting on the zaniest of subjects. The AP, the Associated Press last year, ran an article that advised readers to reduce or eliminate their front lawns, and I guess their back lawns for that matter. The article stated the American lawn, quote, frankly, has no redeeming value aside from subjective aesthetics, end quote. This is another example in a long line of the media's typical promotion of the philosophy of the left. You, as an individual, you might like your lawn, but what you desire does not matter because with the left, it's all about the collective, social utility, and omnipotent government. They're going to dictate what you have and what you don't have. Media will instruct you to fall into line. That's what mainstream media is investing its time and attention to these days versus what it avoids reporting on. It's wrap-up time for this week. We air on January 8th, so happy birthdays to Elvis, who I think we discussed last episode, as well as the Thin White Duke, David Bowie. Was always a fan of Bowie's work, although I think his visual and optics side sometimes took away or distracted from his musical talents. To me, he was an incredible musical talent first and foremost. And Bowie's fashion and visual art aspects, they were never of much interest to me, but I know they were of incredible interest to lots of others, millions of others. And here is my favorite Bowie quote. You would think that a rock star being married to a supermodel would be one of the greatest things in the world. It is. It's a good one. And here's a more substantive quote from Bowie that hints as to what to expect in future Far Middle episodes. I don't know where I'm going from here, but I promise it won't be boring. Indeed, Have a solid week and stay connected to that far middle.